Welcome to another episode with the Ethics Reporter. On the 9th of May 29th, 2024, a black man named Ivan Harper was driving through New Rochelle, New York. He pulled over at a shop. A New Rochelle police lieutenant approached his car. The lieutenant was Sean Kane. Kane was, at the time, the head of the Special Investigation Unit of the New Rochelle Police Department. Special Investigation is an allied plainclothes squad that handles narcotic, organized crime, and the kinds of cases that put people in prison for a long time. Lieutenant Kane was his leader. What happened next is on video, not the defendant's video, not a citizen's video. Lieutenant Kane's video. Kane's own body-worn camera. Kane was at the moment in question recording himself. The video shows Lieutenant Kane sitting in a patrol vehicle. It shows him handling a small clear plastic bag. The bag contains a white powder. Lieutenant Kane manipulates the bag. He looks at it, puts it down. He puts it somewhere we cannot quite see. Then he gets out of his patrol car. He walks to Mr. Harper's vehicle. He bends down. He reached under the car. He stands back up. He is now holding a small clear plastic bag containing a white powder. He has, accordingly to the official narrative, produced that evening, just found drugs under Ivan Harper's car. Ivan Harper has not gotten out of his vehicle. He had not approached his vehicle. He has not handled the bag. The bag has appeared. According to Lieutenant Kane's report from under the car, Mr. Harper is arrested. He is charged with possession of a controlled substance. He is possessed in his book. He is held. Months later, the body camera footage from Lieutenant Kane's own recording device, the footage that was supposed to corroborate his account, is revealed. The footage shows Lieutenant Kane handling a bag of white powder in his patrol vehicle. It shows him manipulating the powder in a way that is not by any innocent interpretation consistent with the routine handling of evidence collected from a scene. It shows what appears to be the deliberate movement of a bag from inside the patrol car to a position that would be later characterized in a sworn report as the discovery of the same bag under another man's vehicle. The drug charges against Ivan Harper are dismissed. Lieutenant Kane is suspended. The case is referred to the Westchester County District Attorney's Office for criminal investigation. A grand jury is impaneled. The grand jury hears the evidence. The grand jury declines to indict Lieutenant Sean Kane. No charges are filed. No prosecution move forward. Kane is, in the eyes of the legal system, not criminally responsible for the events captured on his own body camera. Ivan Harper, on the other hand, has been arrested. He has been booked. He has had drug charges filed against him. He has lived with the prospect of conviction. The charges have been dismissed, but the records of the arrest exist. He has, as the says going, beaten the right but not the right. He continues to live in New Rochelle. Lieutenant Kane, as of the recording of this episode, continues to draw a paycheck from the New Rochelle Police Department. There is a question that the criminal justice system in Westchester County has been asked to answer about Lieutenant Sean Kane. The question is whether Lieutenant Kane is a credible witness. The question is whether his testimony in any criminal case against any defendant or any matter can be trusted enough to send a person to prison. The answer to that question matters. It matters because Kane is a senior officer in a new unit that handles dozens of cases a year. It matters because every case Kane works on relies at some point on his word. It matters because prosecutors who put Kane on the stand know what's on his body camera. It matters because the defendants who face Kane's word in court do not. That question has an official name. It is called Berardi Giglio status. It is a question of whether an officer's documented conduct makes him sufficiently unreliable that prosecutors are constitutionally required to disclose his disciplinary record to defense attorneys in any case where he is a witness. It is a question every prosecutor's office in the United States is supposed to track. It is a question every prosecutor's office in New York State since 2019 is required by statute to track. It is a question that the Westchester County District Attorney's Office, two consecutive administrations, has refused to answer. I am your host, and this is the Ethics Reporter. Tonight, three New Rochelle cops, two Westchester district attorneys, one pattern of denial, and one lease that does not exist because it does. Before we go deep into the story, let me lay out what we are going to talk about and why it matters not just in New Rochelle, but in every prosecutor's office in America. In 2019, the New York State Legislature passed a law called the Discovery of Justice Reform Act. The law was a response to decades of complaints from defense attorneys, civil rights organizations, and the wrongfully convicted. all of whom had been telling the same story for years, the story was this. In New York, prosecutors had a remarkable power. They could withhold evidence from criminal defendants until the eve of trial. They could decline a share witness statement, police report, and physical evidence until the last possible moment. The old law was called by everyone who worked in the system, the blindfold law. Defendants walked into court not knowing what was about to be used against them. They made the decisions in dark. They went to prison on the strength of evidence they had never seen. The Discovery for Justice Reform Act changed that. It replaced the old law, which was called Criminal Procedure Law Article 240, with a new law called Criminal Procedure Law Article 245. Article 245 imposed a duty on prosecutors to automatically disclose to defendants without waiting for a request. On a strict timeline, virtually every category of evidence in the case, police reports, witness statement, body camera footage, forensic results, and critically for tonight's story, the disciplinary records of any law enforcement officer who might testify. The last category, disciplinary record of officers, was the controversial one. It is the category that in every jurisdiction in this country, prosecutors have resisted disclosing for as long as the obligation has existed. It is the category that, when properly disclosed, allows a defense attorney to ask the jury whether the officer testifying in front of them has a history of dishonesty, brutality, or misconduct. It is a category that, when not disclosed, allows innocent people to be convicted on the word of cops whose words should have not been trusted in the first place. The constitutional baseline for this kind of disclosure is older than the New York State statutes. It comes from the two United States Supreme Court cases. The first is Brady versus Maryland, decided in 1963, which held that prosecutors have an affirmative constitutional duty to disclose evidence favorable to the accused. The second is Giglow versus United States, decided in 1972, which held that Brady's duty includes evidence that could be used to impeach the credibility of a government witness, including witness of the witness's prior dishonesty, prior bias, prior misconduct, or any consideration that has been offered in exchange for testimony. Brady and Giglio taken together means this. If the cop testifying for the prosecution has a documented ability problem, the prosecutor has to tell the defense about it, not when the defense acts, not at trial, affirmatively in advance as a matter of constitutional duty. To make this practicable, prosecutors' offices around the country maintain what is formally known as Brady's list. Sometimes it's called a Giglio list. Sometimes it's called a do not call list. Sometimes it is called an adverse credibility list. It is the list of officers whose documented conduct makes them sufficiently unreliable that the prosecutor's office is obligated to disclose their record in any case where they testify. It is also, in many offices, the list of officers the prosecutor's office will not call to testify at all because their credibility is so compromised. Every functioning prosecutor's office in the United States is supposed to maintain such a list. New York CPL Article 245 makes the maintenance and closure of such material affirmatively mandatory. The Westchester County District Attorney's Office is the prosecutor's office for one of the largest counties in New York State. It serves nearly a million residents. It handles thousands of cases a year. It works with dozens of police departments, including the New Rochelle Police Department, the Yonkers Police Department, the Mount Vernon Police Department, the Winchester County Police Department, and many smaller municipal departments. It is staffed by hundreds of assistant district attorneys, supervisors, and paralegals. It is, by any reasonable definition, a major American prosecutor's office. And the Westchester County District Attorney's Office, the public is being told, as of June 2026, does not have a Brady list. It has never had a Brady list. There is no such list because there has never been such a list. Two consecutive district attorneys have presided over a system that, according to the official statement of their office, had produced no documents fitting the description of a list of officers with credibility problems. None. Zero. That is the official statement. The reality is different. The reality is that the same office has, in response to other requests, produced documents that fit precisely that description. The reality is that the office has sought a judge of a court in their own jurisdiction over the question of whether they have to disclose officer disciplinary record. The reality is that the office has lost that fight at the trial level, won and Article 78 proceeding that limited the trial court action, and now sit in front of the Appellate Division Second Department waiting on a decision that could overturn the lower court ruling that has for 3 years allowed them to keep going doing what they are doing. The reality is that the judge who originally ruled in the prosecutor's office favor in 2023, the judge who held that the prosecutor's office could not be sanctioned for late disclosure of officer disciplinary record without a separate showing of prejudice, is now the district attorney of Westchester County. She does not preside over the prosecutor's office that benefits from her own ruling because of an accident. She is the office that benefits from her own ruling. Her name is Susan Kaseki. She was sworn in as a Westchester County District Attorney in January 27, 2025. And so tonight is about three things woven together. It is about the three New Rochelle police officers whose conduct is extensively documented and whose Brady Giglio status to the Westchester County District Attorney's Office were not publicly confirmed. It is about the discovery statute that was supposed to end the blindfold law and a prosecutor's office that has been litigating by stonewalling and by the unique procedural facts of a judge becoming district attorney kept the blindfold in place. And it is about what happens to defendants, people like Irene Harper, to the family of a man named Kamal Flores, to the dozens of defendants whose case the same officers have touched, when the people supposed to be enforcing the rules turn out to be the same people benefiting from breaking them. This is going to be a long episode. There is a lot to cover. Stay with us. To understand what is happening in Westchester County right now, you have to understand what the law in New York used to be, what changed, and what was supposed to change. For most of New York State history, the rule governing what evidence a prosecutor had to share with a criminal defendant was, by national standard, draconian. Other states required prosecutors to turn over their files or substantial portion of their files in advance of trial. Some required it immediately upon their arraignment. New York did not. New York required under the old criminal procedure law, Article 240, that prosecutors share only a narrow set of materials. Police reports would be withheld. Witnesses' statements would be withheld. The defendant would be made to see through the trial proceedings, make lead decisions, and even begin trial without ever having seen the materials that the prosecution was about to use to imprison him. The reason this was tolerated for so long has multiple parts. One part is that the criminal defense bar is in general less politically powerful than the prosecutor's lobby. Another part is that the victims of the blindfold law were poor, black, and Latino, and disproportionately unrepresented by allied counsel who could afford to make political noise. A third part is that the New York criminal justice system, like criminal justice system is in most of this country, has long been organized for institutional convenience rather than for accuracy. The old law was convenient for the prosecution. The old law produced convictions. The old law was the law. By the late 2010s, however, the cause of that law was no longer political deniable. Wrongful conviction cases were accumulating, the innocence project of New York and similar organizations were produced exonerations on a daily basis. Many of those exonerations involve Brady's violations, that is, instances where prosecutors had failed to disclose material exculpatory evidence that, had it been disclosed, would have prevented the conviction in the first place. The pattern was clear enough and the volume large enough that even some prosecutors began acknowledging in public and in print that the old law was indefensible. In 2019, Governor Andrew Cuomo signed into law a package of criminal justice reforms that included sweeping changes to the discovery rules. The blindfold law, CPL Article 240, was repealed. In its place, CPL Article 245 took effect in January 1st. The new law was, by the standards of the New York criminal procedure, revolutionary. Article 245 imposed automatic disclosure obligations. Section 245 required prosecutors to disclose without waiting for a defense request a long list of category of evidence. The list includes police reports, witness statements, the name and contact information of all persons with relevant information, transcript of any prior testimony of witness, all photographs and recordings, the record of any pending criminal investigation of witness, and many other categories. The most controversial category was subsection K. Subsection 245 20 subsection 1 subsection K requires disclosure of, and I am paraphrasing here, all evidence and information known to the prosecution that tends to negate the defendant's guilt. reduce the degree of the defense, support a potential defense, or impinge the credibility of a testifying prosecution witness. The last clause, impeach the credibility, is a clause that imports the Brady Giglio's constitutional duty into the New York statutory regime. Whatever Brady and Giglio's required under the United States Constitution, CPL 245.20 subsection 1 subsection K requires under New York law, and the New York law adds something the federal constitution does not, a strict timeline with sanctions for non-compliance. The timeline matters. Under Article 245, prosecutors must make most disclosures within 20 days of arraignment if the defendant is in custody, or 35 days if the defendant is at liberty. The prosecutor cannot certify the case ready for trial without first filing a certificate of compliance, attesting that the required disclosure have been made. A certificate of compliance that is later shown to be inaccurate, that is, a certification that disclosure were made when in fact they were not, can be challenged in court. A successful challenge can result in the case being deemed not ready for trial, which in turn can have severe procedural consequences under New York Speedy Trial Statute, CPL 30.30. The architects of CPL 245 understood when they wrote the statute. The prosecutors were not going to embrace it. They knew that the office that had spent decades operating under the blindfold law had developed institutional habits that would not change overnight. They knew that the disciplinary records of the police officers Brady Giglio's material were going to be a particular point of resistance. Police department, police unions, and prosecutor's office all had institutional reasons not to want those records shared. Police departments did not want their internal investigations made public. Police unions did not want their members impeached on the stand. Prosecutor's office did not want their cases weakened by the disclosure of credibility problems with their own witnesses. So the drafters of the statute added T, section 245.80, which governs the consequences of non-compliance, set out a series of sanctions a court could impose for failure to comply with disclosure rules. The sanction includes preclusion of evidence, adverse inference instructions, dismissal of charges, and other remedies the court deems just. The statute also included a particular provision that has become the central battleground in the case we are about to discuss. Section 245.80 says, in substance, that a court can sanction late disclosure only upon a showing of prejudice to the defendant. That phrase, upon a showing of prejudice, is a phrase that prosecutors love. It means that even if a prosecutor blows the disclosure deadline, even if a certificate of compliance turns out to have false when filed, a court is not supposed to sanction the prosecutors unless the defense can affirmatively prove that the delay caused some specific harm. This is a higher bar, and is the bar around which the entire Westchester County litigation has revolved. Because here is what happens in the real world. When a prosecutor blows a disclosure deadline, prosecutor files a certificate of compliance saying everything has been disclosed. Defense weeks or months later discover that something was not disclosed. The defense moves for a sanction. The prosecutor responds, yes, this was late, but the defense cannot show prejudice. The defense responds, how can we show prejudice when we did not know the information existed until we just discovered it? This case turns into a procedural fight about whether the prejudice requirement is being applied as a meaningful safeguard or as a trapdoor through which prosecutors can escape every consequences of breaking the rules. The fight in Westchester County between approximately 2021 and the present has been waged with extraordinary visibility in courtrooms, in writ proceedings, in the appellate division, second department, and now in the pages of an independent local newspaper called Talk of the Sound. The fight has produced a record. We are going to walk through that record, and by the end, you will understand why we are calling the episode The List That Doesn't Exist. To understand the Westchester County District Attorney's behavior, you have to understand who specifically the case is about. Tonight's story has three named officers at its center. Their names are Sean Kane, Alec McCarna, and Michael Vaccaro. All three are of the officers of the New Russia Police Department. All three have public records of misconduct that would, in a properly functioning Brady Giglio system, place them squarely on the do not call list at the prosecutor's office. None of them has been confirmed by the district attorney's office to be on any such list. We are going to walk through each one in detail. Lieutenant Sean King has been with the New Russia Police Department for nearly 2 decades. He has been promoted to the rank of Lieutenant. He has been assigned until his recent suspension to lead the Special Investigation Unit, the unit that handles narcotic organized crime and the most consequential investigative work in the department. Lieutenant King has, according to documents reviewed by the independent New Russia News outlet Talk of the Sun, a disciplinary record that is in the publication's world among the worst in the department. The record includes complaints, internal affairs, investigations, and disciplinary findings dating back years before the May 2024 incident with Mr. Harper. The record predates the event in November 24 by a significant margin. The record was on the day Lieutenant King stopped Mr. Harper, already a record that any properly informed prosecutor's office would have flagged. The May 29, 2024 incident is the one that have drawn public attention because of the body camera footage. The footage was not produced by a defendant. It was not produced by a witness. It was produced by the officer himself, Lieutenant King, by the design of New Russia's body worn camera policy, supposed to be recording the interactions with the public. He did the recording captured what the recording captured. We already described what the recording shows. We will not belabor it. What we will say is this. The same Lieutenant King who is on the recording handling a bag of white powder in his patrol vehicle and then claiming to have found a similar bag under Mr. Harper's car is the same Lieutenant King who has in dozens of other cases over his career sworn affidavit, testified at hearings, and provided one statement that placed the defendant in custody. The credibility of his prior testimony in case that did not result in body camera review, in case that did not end dismissal of charge, in case that resulted in convictions, that credibility is, after May 29, 2024, a question that any honest prosecutor would have confronted. After the body camera footage came to light, Lieutenant King was suspended. The case was referred to the Westchester County District Attorney's Office for criminal investigation. A grand jury was impaneled. The grand jury heard the evidence and the grand jury declined to indict Lieutenant King on any charge. There is a saying in legal circles that a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. The saying captures the reality that the grand jury process is nearly every instance dominated by the prosecutor. The grand jury hears the evidence the prosecutor presents. It hears the witnesses the prosecutor calls. It instructed by the prosecutor on the law. It returns the indictment the prosecutor asked. The standard is probable cause, a standard for lower than the standard required at trial. Grand juries do not refuse to indict cause. Grand juries do not, in practice, push back on the people running them. So when a grand jury in Westchester County presented a case in which it targets own body camera shows the conduct in question declines to indict, this is the fact worth examining. It is not necessarily proof of corruption. It is not necessarily proof that the prosecutor's office threw the case. The grand jury sometimes returned no true bills for legitimate reason, but it is a fact that requires explanation. And the Westchester County District Attorney's Office has not publicly explained it. Lieutenant Kane was not indicted. The drug charges against Ivan Harper were dismissed. The body camera footage exists. The official position of the legal system on Lieutenant Kane as of the recording of this episode is that there is insufficient evidence to charge him with a crime. Lieutenant Kane has not been confirmed or denied as being on the body's ridiculous list of Westchester County District Attorney's Office because the office now says the list does not exist. On June 5th, 2020, 12 days after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, in a summer when the country was in the streets over police violence, Officer Alec McConnell of the New Rochelle Police Department shot and killed a 24-year-old black man named Kamal Flores. The shooting took place during what officers later described as a traffic stop. The circumstances of the stop, the use of force, and the official narrative produced after the shooting have been the subject of litigation, journalism, and community organizing for the better part of 6 years. We are not going to relitigate the shooting itself on this podcast. This is not what tonight's episode is about. What we are going to address is what came after. What we are going to address is what was in Officer McKenna's personal file at the time he shot Kamal Flores. What we are going to address is what the district attorney's office knew or should have known or did not bother find out about Officer McKenna's record before, during, or after the killing of Mr. Flores. Officer McKenna's personal file, according to records reviewed by Talk of Sound and other reporters on tape and extraordinary record,
The reporting describes 158 separate violations documented in a single 62-day investigation period. This is not a typographical error. 158 violations, 62 days. The record describes a documented pattern of disabling the in-car recording equipment in his patrol vehicle during traffic stops. The pattern disabling the recording equipment that was provide independent revision of an officer account of a stop is by itself the kind of pattern that should disqualify an officer from being relied upon in witness. In any case, while the officer's account of a stop is the critical evidence, an officer who has been documented running of his own camera during stop is an officer whose words on what happened during any computer service as a matter of basic evidentiary reasoning suspect. Officer McKenna was the officer whose words was the critical evidence about what happened on the night of June 5th, 2020. There was no other body camera footage. There was no civilian witness to the moment of the shooting. There was Officer McKenna's account, and Officer McKenna's account was basis upon which the killing of Kamal Flowers was officially classified. After the post-shooting review as a justified use of force, the district attorney's office at the time of the shooting was not yet headed by Miriam Roca, who would take office in 2021, or by Susan, who would take office in 2025. It was headed by Anthony Scarpino, the Westchester County District Attorney, in 2017 to 2021. The deposition of the Flowers shooting was Scarpino's responsibility. The decisions about whether to convene a grand jury, what evidence to present, what charges, if any, to seek, those decisions were made under his administration. The shooting was classified as justified. Officer McKenna was not charged. Officer McKenna remained on the New Rochelle Police Department after that shooting. He has continued in the years since to be an officer who could, in principle, be called as a witness in criminal cases. The question of whether he can be lawfully called, whether his record made him a witness, that must be closed as a Brady Eagles problem, is a question the Westchester County District Attorney's Office has used to answer. We do not know whether McKenna has testified in cases since the shooting. We do not know whether prosecutors have in any case involving McKenna's disclosure the 158 violations or any pattern of disabling recording equipment to defense. We can guess, based on the official position of the office, that nobody giggles this because that the answer is at minimum unclear and, well, maybe no. The third officer is Detective Michael Vaccaro. Detective Vaccaro's record is in some ways the most extensively documented of the three because it has reached points of former state action. We will get to that in a moment. Detective Vaccaro joined the New Rochelle Police Department in the early 20s over a roughly 15-year period from approximately 2006 to 2020. His disciplinary file accumulated 17 documented matters. The matters span a range of misconduct. They include a 10-day suspension for making false statements, that is, an internal finding that Detective Vaccaro lied in an official capacity. The making of false statements by a police officer is, in any rational Brady Giglio's analysis, the kind of finding that should result in immediate permanent dismissal on the do not call list of any prosecutor's office in a jurisdiction. An officer who has been found to have lied in an official capacity cannot ethically be presented to a jury as a credible witness without disclosure of the prior finding of the dishonest. Vaccaro's file also includes a March 2020 matter in which, according to documents reviewed by Talk of Sound, he assessed the Thompson Reuters-led database without a legitimate police purpose. CLEAR is a commercial investigative database used by law enforcement for legitimate background check and casework. Assessing it for non-investigative purpose is a serious matter. The specific allegation is that Detective Vaccaro searched a name on what is sometimes called a VIP or PEP watch list. That is an entity in a watch list of politically exposed persons or other individuals of public interest. The search was, according to the reporting, undertaken for purposes that have not been publicly examined as a legitimate police work. In addition to several internal disciplinary matters, Detective Vaccaro has been the subject of state action. Effective September 1st, 2023, Detective Vaccaro was decertified by the New York State Division of Criminal Justice System. The certification was also under Civil Service Law, Section 75, and the related state regulations governing the certification of police officers. The certification is the most serious form of state level degree that can be imposed on a police officer short of criminal prosecution. It strips the officer of the legal authority to function as a police officer in New York State. A decertified officer cannot lawfully exercise the power of arrest, the power of search and seizure, or the power of testimony as a sworn law enforcement officer. It is in the universe of administrative consequences for police misconduct, the nuclear option. Detective Vaccaro was decertified more than 2.5 years ago before this episode aired. This decertification is by definition a public record. The state agency that maintains the certification database has in its record an entry showing that of September 1st, 2023, Michael Vaccaro is no longer a certified police officer in New York. Any prosecutor's office that does basic diligence that periodically checks the certification status of officer whose case they handle would have known within hours of the decertification. And yet, as of June 2026, the Westchester County District Attorney's Office, in response to former FOIL requests under New York's Freedom of Information Law, has stated that it does not maintain a Brady's Igloo's list. It has stated that no records exist responsive to requests for the credibility status of officers Kane, McKenna, and Vaccaro. We will come back to that statement in a few minutes because the same office in the same time period has produced documents that are themselves Brady Giglo's disclosure records prepared under CPL 245.20 subsection 1 subsection K. Documents that by definition are records of the credibility status of officers, documents whose existence the office has in writing denied. Those are the three cops, Sean Kane, Alec McKenna, Michael Vaccaro, one caught on his own body camera planting evidence, one with 158 violations and a documented pattern of disabling recording equipment, who shot a 24-year-old black man to death in 2020, one decertified by the state and yet whose Brady Giglo status the office now claims does not exist as a track category. These are the officers whose case this episode is about. These are the officers whose status the public is being told does not exist on any list, in any database, in any record of the prosecutor's office, whose statutory duty is to maintain exactly what the kind of list is. Now, let us talk about the district attorney who promised in 2020 to release that list. In 2020, in the year that George Floyd was murdered and the year that Tamar Flores was killed by Officer McKenna, a former federal prosecutor named Miriam Butcher ran for Westchester County District Attorney. She ran as a reformer. She ran on transparency. She ran on the kind of platform that was in the summer of 2020, the platform a Democratic prosecutorial candidate had to run on if she wanted to win in a county like Westchester. Roca's biography was the biography of an establishment Democrat with reformist instincts. She had spent more than a decade as an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York. She had worked on terrorism cases. She had been a legal analyst on cable news, where she had made a national profile critiquing the conduct of the first Trump administration. She had the resume of a credible prosecutorial reformer. She had the name recognition of a capable commentator. She had the support of the Westchester County Democratic establishment. She won the primary. She won the general. She was sworn in as Westchester County District Attorney in January 2021. Among the specific commitments workers made during her campaign and during her transition was a commitment to public transparency about police credibility. She committed in public statement to release an adverse credibility list, a public list of officers whose documented conduct made them unsuitable as witness in criminal cases. She did not invent the concept of such a list. Other prosecutors had begun maintaining and disclosing such lists. The District Attorney of Brooklyn had taken steps in that direction. The District Attorney of Philadelphia had been doing it. The District Attorney of San Francisco had been doing it. In the summer of 2020, with the country in the streets over police violence, the police release of a credibility list was the kind of thing a Democratic reformer was expected to commit to.
Roca committed to it. She committed to it in public. She committed to it in record. And then for 4 years, she did not do it. During her tenure, from January 2021 to January 2025, when she was succeeded by Susan Carcase, the Westchester County District Attorney's Office did not publicly release any adverse credibility list. It did not release a list naming officers whose record made them unreliable witnesses. It did not release a list naming Sean Kane. It did not release a list naming Alec Bekena. It did not release a list naming Michael Vaccaro. The list, whatever form it took, remained internal. Defense attorneys received radical disclosures on a case-by-case basis. When the office determined that the constitutional duty applied to a particular case and not otherwise, the aggregate list, the list that would have answered for every defense attorney in the country, the question of whose word the prosecutor's office had already concluded could not be trusted, was not produced. Why? The official explanation to the extent the office produced one was that the production of such a list raised privacy concerns about officers whose disciplinary records were protected by various state laws. That law, before it repealed in 2020 June, has shielded police personnel records from public disclosure. After it repealed, the records were available. But the office took the position that aggregating them into a public list raised concerns and needed to balance against transparency. The explanation was, at the time, contested. Defense attorneys argued that the production of an aggregate list was not just permissible after the repeal of 50A, but legally required as part of the prosecutor's affirmative burden Higlo's duty. Civil rights organizations argued that the privacy concerns were a pretext for not doing the thing the district attorney had publicly committed to. The arguments continued for 4 years. The list was never released. And there is another dimension of this story that we need to surface. The district attorney's office during the Rutgers administration hired into high-level intelligence position an individual who, according to public reporting, had himself appeared on a list of New York City officers with credibility problems. The publication Black Westchester reported on his hiring in 2021, the individual hired into the intelligence position was, according to the reporting, on a list in another jurisdiction, had been compiled precisely because of credibility issues. The hiring suggested at the very least that the Rutgers administration commitment to using credibility lists as the basis for prosecutorial decisions was not absolute. The optics were bad, the substance was worse, and the office did not respond to reporting in any way that resolved the contradiction. So we have, as at the end of the Rutgers administration in January 2025, the following facts on the record. The district attorney had to run on the promise of transparency. The promise included a specific commitment to release a public credibility list. The list had not been released. The office had hired into a sensitive position a person previously identified as having credibility problems on a list from another jurisdiction. Defense attorneys in the counties continue to receive a ridiculous disclosure on a piecemeal basis, sometimes after sustained litigation and sometimes not at all. The blindfold law had been repealed, but the practical effects of the new law had been blunted by the office resistance to its full implementation. This is the state affairs of the Carcase administration inherited when it took office on January 27, 2025. If Rutgers silence was the politics of the matter, the law of the matter, the actual case law produced by the conflict between CPL 245 and the prosecutor's office institutional habit was being made elsewhere. In a much smaller courtroom, by much smaller famous judges, his name was Matthew J. Costa. He sat as a judge of the New Rochelle City Court. New Rochelle City Court is by the standards of New York system. A court of limited jurisdiction, it handles miscellaneous traffic infractions, small civil matters. It is the kind of court most citizens never see and most journalists never cover. It is also the court in which, in the years after CPL 245 took effect, some of the most important rulings about the practical enforcement of the new discovery law in Westchester County were made. Judge Costa took CPL 245 seriously. That is the simplest and most accurate way to describe his conduct on the bench. The statute imposed specific duties on prosecutors. The statute provided for sanctions if those duties were not met. Judge Costa presented with cases in which Westchester County District Attorney's Office had failed to comply with the disclosure requirements, imposed the sanctions statute authorized. Specifically, in a series of cases that began locating up around 2021 and 2022, Judge Costa found that the prosecutor's office had filed certificates of compliance that were not, in fact, accurate. The certificate had attested that disclosures were complete when they were not. Officer disciplinary records had not been disclosed. Body camera footage had not been disclosed. Witnesses' identification information had not been disclosed. In multiple cases, after the certification of compliance had been filed and the prosecution had taken position that the cases were ready for trial, defense attorneys had identified materials that had never been disclosed. Judge Costa, on the face of the statute, imposed the sanctions the statute permitted. In one case, he found a certificate of compliance invalid. The finding was significant because under the statute, the case cannot be deemed ready for trial without a valid certificate of compliance. An invalid certificate has consequences under CPL 30.20, the speedy trial statute, which can result in the dismissal of charges if the prosecution is not ready the statutory time limit. Judge Costa sanctioned the prosecutor's office by precluding testimony of state trooper, which effectively ended the prosecution in the case. In another case, the prosecutor's office declined to produce training manuals related to testing without first obtaining court approval to withhold them. Judge Costa sanctioned the office again, this time by precluding the Brit Laser's test data and the Hughes Sobriety test testimony. The two sanctions taken together established a pattern. The pattern was that Judge Costa was in his court enforcing the statute that the New York State Legislature had enacted. The pattern was that the prosecutor's office was being held to the duties the statute imposed. The pattern was that the blindfold law in New Rochelle City Court was actually gone. The district attorney's office did not accept this. The office responded by filing what is known as an Article 78 proceeding. The Article 78 of the Civil Practice Law and Rules is the procedural mechanism by which a party can challenge the conduct of a state officer, including a judge. In the New York Supreme Court, the remedy sought in Article 78 proceeding can include a writ of prohibition, which an order from a higher court directing a lower court not to take a particular action. The district attorney filed an Article 78 proceeding seeking a writ of prohibition against Judge Costa. The writ would have, if granted, prohibited Judge Costa from enforcing CPL 245 in the manner he had been enforcing it. That is, by any reasonable reading, a remarkable use of state legal process. The district attorney's office, faced with a trial judge enforcing a statute the legislation had passed, did not appeal the rulings through the ordinary appellate process. The office instead sought an extraordinary writ, a writ that, if granted, would have ordered the judge to stop applying the law as the legislation had written it. The office took the position, in effect, that the judge was overstepping his authority by enforcing the statute. The office took the position that the prosecutor's office discretion in applying the disclosure rule was, in essence, beyond the trial's court reach. The Article 78 proceeding was filed in August 2022. Judge Costa moved to dismiss the district attorney's complaint in October 2022. His motion to dismiss was denied. The case was seated in December 2022. The litigation entered what talk of the sound described as round two, additional motion practice, additional briefing, additional arguments. And on January 30th, 2023, the Article 78 proceeding produced a decision. The decision was issued by a judge of the Westchester County Supreme Court who had been assigned to the matter. The judge ruled in favor of the district attorney's office. The judge ruled against Judge Costa. The judge held that the court could not sanction prosecutors for late disclosure of officer disciplinary record absent a separate showing of prejudice to the defendant. The judge held in substance that the prejudice requirement of CPL 245.80 was a precondition that the defendant had satisfied before any sanction could be imposed. And the judge Costa had not adequately required defendant to make that showing before sanctioning the prosecutor's office. The decision was significant. It was a New York Supreme Court ruling that constrained the trial court's enforcement of CPL 245. It made future sanctions more difficult to obtain. It strengthened the prosecutor's office position that even the disclosure obligation had been violated, the consequences would not flow to the prosecution. It was in the assessment of defense attorneys and civil rights advocates familiar with the case a substantial blow to the practical enforceability of the discovery reforms. The judge was issued the decision was the Honorable Susan Kakase. Let us state the procedural facts plainly, because it is a kind of fact that if you say it too quickly sounds like an accusation when it's actually a description. On January 30th, 2023, the Honorable Suzanka Case, then a justice of New York Supreme Court for Westchester County, issued a decision in Article 78 proceeding brought by the Westchester County District Attorney's Office against the Honorable Matthew J. Costa, a judge of New Rochelle City Court. The decision held that the trial courts could not sanction prosecutors for late disclosure of officer disciplinary records without a separate showing of prejudice to the defendant. The decision was a victory for the district attorney's office. Less than 2 years later, on January 27, 2025, the same Suzanka Case was sworn in as Westchester district attorney. She is now the head of the office that won the Article 78 proceeding she decided in 2023. She is the chief executive of the prosecutor's office, whose litigation position she ruled in favor as a judge. The ruling she issued as a judge is now the legal precedent on which her own office relies in continuing the practices that produced the original statute. Now, let us be careful. Judges become district attorneys all the time. There is nothing illegitimate on its face about a former judge running and for winning a prosecutorial office. The career path from the bench to a district attorney's office is a well-trodden in New York and in most American states. The fact that the transition is not by itself evidence of an impropriety. Judges make rulings. Judges leave the bench. Judges take other positions. Judges run for office. This is how the legal profession works. We are not suggesting that Suzanka Case did anything improper by citing the 2023 Article 78 proceeding and then 2 years later becoming the district attorney of the office that had brought the proceeding. What we are saying is something different. What we are saying is that the specific procedural posture that has resulted in a judge who ruled in favor of the secretary's office now running that office, and that office now sitting on a pending appeal of her ruling and the appellate division second department, creates a set of dynamics that the public is entitled to understand. Let us start with the appeal Judge Costa, after the January 30th, 2023 ruling against him, exercised his rights to appeal. He filed a notice of appeal on February 7th, 2023. The appeal was assigned docket number 2023-02319 in the Appellate Division, 2nd Department. The 2nd Department is the Intermediate Appellate Court, whose jurisdiction includes Westchester County. It is the court that the ordinary course of New York appellate practice would decide whether Judge Case's ruling was correct as a matter of law. The appeal has been pending for more than 3 years. According to the public docket, the appeal was on the court's calendar on November 20, 2025. A decision has not yet been issued. As of the recording of this episode, in late June 2026, the appeal remains pending. The second department could issue a decision next week. It could issue a decision next month. It could issue a decision next year. The court does not, as a matter of practice, telegraph the timing of the decision. If the second department affirms Judge Kake's ruling, the law will be settled. The prosecutor's office position will be vindicated. The blunting of CPL 245 sanction provisions in Westchester County will continue. The district attorney's office will continue to function under the rule that it cannot be sanctioned for late disclosure of officer disciplinary records without a separate showing of prejudice. A rule that, as we have discussed, is in practice extremely difficult for defendants to satisfy. If the second department reverses Judge Kake's ruling, the law will be different. The trial court in Westchester County will once again have the authority Judge Costa exercised. Sanctions will be available without the additional layer of prejudice showing. The prosecutor's office will, in the wake of the reversal, find its litigation position substantially weakened, depending and future cases in which the office had filed certificates of compliance that may turn out to be inaccurate will become more vulnerable to dismissal. And here is where the procedural posture becomes interesting in a way that, again, we want to be careful about characterizing. The person who heads the office whose intent interests are at stake in the appeal is the same person whose ruling is on appeal. District Attorney Kakas is, by virtue of her current office, a party in interest in the very appeal that may overturn her own prior decision. The office she heads is funded by the public, staffed by public employees and tasked with representing the public's interest in criminal prosecution. The office litigation position independent appeal, the brief and the office has filed the argument. The office has made the resources. The office has devoted to defending the parolee is the position of the district attorney. Now, in the ordinary practice of New York appellate law, the office of the attorney general often represents the prosecutorial interests of the appellate level in cases of statewide significance. We do not, at this stage of our investigation, know the position who is briefing the case ruling on appeal. We know that the district attorney's office has institutional interest in the outcome. We know the district attorney is the person who issued the ruling under a review. We know that regardless of who signs the brief, the district attorney's office institutional reputation and ongoing litigation posture are intertwined with the outcome. This is the kind of situation that any first-year law student would recognize as creating an appearance problem. We are not saying it is a conflict of interest in any technical form or technical sense. We have not done that analysis under the specific provision of New York judicial conduct rules and prosecutorial conduct rules necessary to make that determination. We are saying this, it is on its face an arrangement that creates an appearance that bears explanation. The district attorney's office should, in our view, be answering questions about this arrangement publicly. The public is entitled to know what role the district attorney is playing in the pending appeal. The public is entitled to know whether the district attorney has recused herself from any internal office decisions about the appeal. The public is entitled to know whether the office litigation position has been shaped by the fact that the person whose prior ruling is at stake now heads of the office. As of the recording of this episode, those questions have not been publicly answered. The district attorney's office has not, to our knowledge, issued a public statement addressing the appearance problem. The office has not made any public commitment to recursive procedures. The office has not, in its communication with the press, acknowledged the unusual procedural posture or explained how it's been managed. And it brings us to the second dimension of the story, the dimension that turns the appearance problem from a procedural curiosity into a substantial scandal. Because while the appeal is ending, while the public is being told that the prior ruling is being defended on its merit, the district attorney's office has continued in its day-to-day operation to take operations and positions on the existence of very records the discovery statute was supposed to require disclosure, and those positions were examined carefully and they do not add up. On June 13, 2026, days before the recording of this episode, the publication Talk of the Sound published an article with a headline that in fewer than 15 words covered the essence of what the ninth episode is about. The headline was, Westchester DA produced disciplinary records for three new Rochelle officers, then said no such record exists. Talk of the Sound, in the months leading up to June 13th article, has submitted a series of Freedom of Information Law requests to the Westchester County District Attorney's Office. New York FOIL statute codified at Public Office Law Section 87 and following requires government agencies to produce records in response to specific requests subject to enumerated exceptions of privilege or confidential material. The request submitted to the District Attorney's Office sought records relating to Brady Giggs' status of three specially named Officer Lieutenant Sean Kane, Officer Alec McKenna, and Detective Michael Vaccaro. The requests were specific. They asked in substance, does your office maintain a list of officers with adverse credibility finding? Is each of the named officer on that list? What disclosure has your office made to defense attorneys regarding each named officer's credibility? What internal document discuss the credibility status of each named officer? These are not exotic questions. These are the kind of requests that in any prosecutor's office that is properly complying with the CPL 245.20 subsection 1A should have already answered. The records sought are records the office is required by law to maintain. The disclosure of those records to defense attorneys in case where the named officers are witnesses is a constitutional and statutory duty. The maintenance of an internal tracking system for such records is in any well-run prosecutor's office a basic operational practice. The district attorneys office responded to the request. The response in substance was no responsive record exists. The office position was that there was nobody Kigulo's list, no adverse credibility list, no documents fitting the description of the records of the FOIL request sought. The office stated in writing that the record the request sought did not exist, and then in the same time period, the office produced records that fit exactly the description of the records the office had did not exist. The record the office produced were what are known internally as CO2 disclosure document. CO2 is a designation of a specific type of compliance document designed by the office under CPL 245.20 subsection 1A. CO2 designation refers to the office internal tracking of disclosure obligation related to officer impeachment material. The CO2 document, by their nature, document the office assessment of an officer's credibility profile for purpose of disclosure to the defense in pending cases. The office produced CO2 document for all three named officers. The document existed. The document had been prepared. The documents were responsive to the FOIL request, and the documents were by definition the kind of records the office had told the requesters not exist. Now, let us be precise about what the contradiction means. There are two possible interpretations of the contradiction. The first interpretation is the FIL office made a mistake. The FOIL office in its initial response did not understand the request or did not check the right record. The second interpretation is that the FOIL office understood the request precisely, knew the record existed, and then provided a written response stating that it did not, because the office referred public brochure is that no such record exists. Under this interpretation, the production of the CO2 document was either a mistake by a different part of the office that did not coordinate with the FOIL response, intentional production made in response to follow up pressure that the office did not feel it could continue to resist. We do not, at this stage of our reporting, know which interpretation is correct. We do not have the internal communications of the district attorney's office. We have not been able to interview the FIL officers who issued the initial response. We have not been able to interview the prosecutors or compliance officer who authorized the production of the CO2 document. The district attorney's office has not, to our knowledge, publicly examined or explained the contradiction. What we can say is this: under either interpretation, the contradiction is a problem. If the FOIL office made a mistake, then the office compliance with FOIL is at minimum not what it should be, and the public is entitled to know what process has been instituted to prevent same mistake from happening again. If the FIL office did not make a mistake, if the office official's public brochure is not a bad regulous list exists, while at the same time, the office actual practice involved in maintenance and production of records that fit the description, then the public is entitled to know that the official public brochure is not a description of reality. There is a further dimension to that what we need to address. The official brochure that no list exists is not a brochure that holds up under the most basic scrutiny once the CO2 documents have been produced. The CO2 documents are, by their nature, a list. They are a list maintained by the Office of Officers whose credibility profiles raise disclosure obligations under CPL 245.20 subsection 1A. The list may not be in the form of a single title document called by the key closed list. The list may exist as a collection of individual CO2 records organized by officers. The list may exist as a database. The list may exist as a set of internal memoranda. The form is not what matters. What matters is the function, and the function, the office assessment of which officers have credibility issues that trigger disclosure duties, is exactly what a bad ridiculous list is. So when the office says no list exists, the office is at a minimum engaged in systematic gamemanship. The office is saying we do not have a document called the list. The office is not saying we do not have records of officer credibility assessment. The record exists. The records have been produced. The records are in substance and in legal effect, and the list the office says does not exist. This is the contradiction of the heart of the ninth episode. Two consecutive district attorneys have presided over a same in which a list maintained for purposes of CPL 245.20 subsection 1K compliance does not exist. In the official public communications of the office exists. The list does in fact exist. The list has been produced. The record shows that the list exists. And the official position is that it does not. And while the contradiction has been unfolding, the three officers whose names are on the record
the office said does not exist and continue to be officers in New Rochelle Police Department. Vaccaro certified by the state in September 2023. McKenna, the officer who killed Kamal Flowers in January 2020, came captured on his own body camera in May 2024. All three women officers whose words in any case where they testify is the kind of word a properly functioning prosecutor's office would not allow to present to a jury without robust disclosure of every credible content in their files. So let's talk about what all this means under the rules that govern the legal profession. The lawyers in New York State are governed by the New York Rules of Professional Conduct. The rules were adopted by the Appellate Division in 2009 and have been amended periodically since. They apply to every lawyer admitted to practice in the state, including every assistant district attorney, every supervising assistant district attorney, and every elected district attorney. The rules are enforced by the Attorney Grievance Committee of the four appellate departments. The committees have had authority to discipline lawyers for violations up to and including the There is a specific rule that applies to prosecutors, Rule 3.8, Subsection B. The subsection of the rule addresses the prosecutor's disclosure obligation. The rule does not require a Brady-Giglio violation to be charged as a crime for it to result in discipline. The rule does not require a defendant to have been wrongfully convicted. The rule does not even require the prosecutor's non-compliance to have been intentional. A prosecutor who fails to make timely disclosure of evidence that tends to negate guilt, including impeachment material about a testifying officer, has violated Rule 3.8. The violation is a basis for discipline. The discipline can range from a private letter of caution to disbarment. Beyond Rule 3.8, prosecutors are governed by the General Rule of Professional Conduct, Rule 8, Subsection 4C, prohibits a lawyer from engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, and misrepresentation. Rule 8, Subsection 4D, prohibits conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. Rule 3, Subsection 3, governing conduct towards the tribunal, prohibit a lawyer from knowingly making false statements of fact or law to a tribunal. Rule 3, Subsection 4, governing fairness to opposing counsel, prohibit suppressing evidence and prohibit engaging in obstructive conduct. Now apply these rules to what we have been describing tonight. Under Rule 3, Subsection 8D, a district attorney's office that has sealed two documents documenting the credibility issues of three named officers and that does not consistently disclose those documents to defense attorneys in case where the officers testify, has a Rule 3, Subsection 8 problem. The disclosure obligation is not optional. It is not subjected to a balance test that the prosecutor's office gets performed internally. It is a categorical duty. Under Rule 8, Subsection 4C, a district attorney's office that responds to FOI requests by saying records do not exist, and then in the same time period produces records that fit the description of the records the office said did not exist, has a rule problem. The first response was either a misrepresentation or it was not. If it was a misrepresentation, the rule has been violated. Now let's talk about what this caused specific people. Irvin Harper, a black man from New Rochelle, was pulled over in May 2024 and framed, caught on officer's own body camera. The charges were dismissed. The grand jury declined to indict the officer. Harper still lives in New Rochelle, still drives those streets, still carries that trauma. And because the misconduct is in his case happened to be caught on camera, he is the case we know about. In any system where an officer is caught planting evidence once, there are earlier cases where there are no camera caught. Defendants who couldn't afford to push back and who bled out, who went to prison, who don't have their names, their arithmetic says it exists. Kamal Flowers, 24-year-old, was shot and killed by Officer Alec McKenna on June 5, 2020. His family in New Rochelle has pushed for accountability through protests, a civil suit, and community organizing without success. McKenna's disciplinary file with 158 documented violations in 62-day stretch exists before the shooting. We don't know if factored into the official finding that the shooting was justified. We know the finding was that it was justified and that McKenna stayed on the force.
And then there are dozens of other defendants whose case involved these three officers over the past 5 years. Drug case, gun case, DWIs. Each defendant was legally entitled to those officers' disciplinary records. Whether they received them, in what form, how completely, we can verify, because the records have never been compiled or compiled publicly. The cost here is a specific currency. Plea deals taken under threat of charges that proper disclosure should have undermined. Convictions built on testimony that should have been impeached. Years of liberty lost under the pretense that system was working. These aren't abstractions. They are specific people. This is a local story, but it is a local instance of national one. Across the country, prosecutors' offices routinely know which officer they work with have credibility problems, and disclosure of that information remains partial, inconsistent, and often late. When trial courts try to enforce disclosure, prosecutors typically appeal through procedures designed to block that enforcement. This isn't as accidental. It is product of decades of institutional pressure from prosecutorial associations and police unions. Some jurisdictions, Brooklyn, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Manhattan, Los Angeles, have made real progress. Publicly, former tracking system, training programs, others have walked back earlier reform entirely. Westchester County sits in between. It elects reform-minded DAs, but the office's institutional resistance and its dependence on police cooperation consistently wins out. This is the familiar act. Reformers run on transparency, win takes office, meets resistance from career staff and police unions, and accommodate rather than confront. The promised list never appears. The reform practice continues underneath reform era branding. That happened under the Ruka. It has continued unchanged under the Eka case. The office official position is that no list exists. Records produced under FYL pressure show otherwise. The contradiction hasn't been resolved, just documented and ignored. This episode exists because of independent local journalism family Robert Cossack's of The Sound, along with New Roar News and Black Purchaser magazines, which broke the story of a credibility flagged officer being hired into a sensitive role. These are small, tiny resource outlets during the FYL request, court watching, and documentation that larger people have largely abandoned. Meanwhile, the institution built to provide actual accountability have been doing nothing visible. The state attorney general hasn't investigated. The state senate code committee hasn't held hearings. The state bar association hasn't issued a single resolution. The attorney grievance committee, bound by its own confidentiality rules, has been produced no public sessions, and we don't even know how many complaints have been filed. The country board of legislators, which funds the DA office and has authority to summon the DA for testimony, hasn't done so. The journalism exists, the accountability does not. This story sits on top of a 60-year-old constitutional doctrine that has never been reliable enforced. In 1963, Brady versus Maryland held that prosecutors must disclose evidence favorable to the accused, regardless of good or bad faith. In 1972, Giglio versus United States extended that duty to impeachment evidence, including any deals made with witnesses, and held that the duty belongs to the prosecutor's office, not the individual trial attorney, meaning the office knows it must disclose even if the trial prosecutor personally didn't know it. Both really were ambitious, neither came with real enforcement teeth. The remedy for a violation is reversal on appeal, which requires a defendant with the resource to find suppressed evidence and litigate it, something most defendants don't have. So in practice, most Brady's violations go unremedied. New York CPL Article 245 passed in 2019 tried to close that gap with automatic disclosure rules, strict deadlines, certificates of compliance actionable at the trial level before conviction. Judge Matthew Costa enforced the statute exactly as written. The DA's office fought back through an Article 78 proceedings, and Judge Susan Kakei's January 2023 release constrained how aggressively trial judge could sanction the office. The ruling is now on appeal to the Second Department, pending for over 3 years. So the Westchester fight is really about whether Article 245 will be allowed to close the 50-year-old Radice enforcement gap, or whether litigation will push the law back towards the old, weaker constitutional default. That's the national story playing out in the local courtroom. We've described a system with four parts: a law, CPL, Article 245 that exists on the books, a prosecutor's office that has compiled with it partially, inconsistently, and at times misleadingly. A court system where enforcement is unresolved and an appeal has sat for 3 years, and an accountability infrastructure. The Attorney Grievance Committee, the AG, the State Bar, the State Senate, the County Board, the voters that have not visibly acted. The result, a credibility list that maintained internally and denied publicly. The maintenance is documented, the denial is documented. Nothing changes until someone with actual authority decides to act. Several things could change this tomorrow if anyone chose to. The second department to reverse the Kakei's ruling and restore re-sanction power to the trial judges. The DA's office could simply admit the list exists and start releasing names subject to privacy protections. The Attorney General or the Grievance Committee could open an investigation. The County Board could hold a hearing and call the DA to testify. The State Senate could examine whether these patterns extend beyond Westchester. The major paper, Times, the Daily News, the Post could give the time sustained coverage. Talk of the sound has been given it alone. None of that requires new legislation. It requires people already in position of authority choosing to use it. Ivan Harper was framed on camera by an officer who was never indicted and whose word is still usable. In court, Kamal Flowers was killed by an officer with 158 documented violations, and the shooting was ruled justified. Michael Vakharov, decertified by the state over 2 years ago, still isn't publicly confirmed as flat. Even though the office owns FYI production shows that he is, this is what happens when no one with power to act decides to use it. Documenting that is what they owe you. Acting on it is what they owe you. Independent legal ethics journalism, no advertisers, no corporate sponsors, just the truth. I'm your host, and this has been The Ethics Reporter. If you want to support the podcast, donate at theethicsreporter.com. If you have a tip about misconduct by any judge, prosecutor's office, or bar association, send it to the tip line at theethicsreporter.com/tip. We read everything. Until next time, this is The Ethics Reporter.